Welcome to That Makes Total Sense, a podcast dedicated to exploring God's generosity and justice. I'm Alexis Busetti, a Christian aiming to ask good questions and encouraging you to do the same. Every one of us is wired by God to live out generosity and justice, but the how sometimes eludes us. That Makes Total Sense is a way for us to get together, posture ourselves as learners, and challenge one another to practice generosity and justice in a tangible way every day. Hey, everybody. I am like beyond excited. I'm already emotional. I don't know, Kelly, is this because you're a psychologist? Do you just bring out the emotion in people? They just sit in front of you and just start crying. Is this what happens?
With my writing, at least when I try to write like a psychologist, that doesn't happen. But when I try to tap into what is human, you know, which I've learned from my clients and learned from myself, then it tends to bring out the emotion. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I've already told him I'm mad at him. First, I'm going to introduce him and then I'll tell you why I'm mad at him. Our guest, I don't usually start off that way, by picking a beef online, but here we go. Kelly Flanagan is my guest today. We chatted last year. We decided it'd been over a year since we chatted, about your previous book, True Companions, which was, I read it by the pool. It was not necessarily a pool read, but it was a fantastic read. I mean, that was one I have said I would revisit and I haven't, but now I'm reminded that I need to, because it was so powerful and meaningful about relationships and how we walk through things together as community. It was wonderful. And then you've written a novel.
Yeah, I have.
You wrote a novel. It's called The Unhiding of Elijah Campbell. I don't read novels. I don't read fiction very often.
Yeah.
And so I, you know, was like, saw this come through my email. I was like, hands up. I want to talk to Kelly again for sure. It was a blast. And then I've got to be honest. I like pushed send to your publicist. And then I was like, what have I done?
I'm so glad you did it.
I've been in, you know, book clubs, right, and stuff like that, like way back in the day. But I'm like, I have never recorded a podcast conversation with an author who has written a novel. And I was nervous about that. But I'll be real, I was also nervous because I wasn't sure what my experience was going to be like reading a Christian novel.
Right. And
and that goes back to why I'm mad at you, because I spent the morning with my regular drink at my regular coffee shop, lifting up my glasses and wiping my tears as I finished like the last, it was like 80 or 100 pages of your book. It was beautiful. It was real. It felt raw and human in a lot of places. And it was suspenseful.
I turned every
page. I felt like I couldn't turn fast enough. I was irritated when I got interrupted. I needed to know what was going to happen with Elijah.
That is music to an author's ears, let me tell you.
He became my friend, right? I wanted to know what was going to happen to Elijah in this book. So thank you. Thank you for writing it, and thank you for putting it out there, and thank you for coming on to talk to me about it today.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for all of that. And until just a couple of weeks ago, I had never been a guest on a podcast where I was talking about a novel I had written either. So this is really pretty new to me too. So we'll like sort of co-create this together.
That's right. We'll go together. So before I get into my first like question, I think that'll kind of kick us off into what I think promises to be a really wonderful conversation. I just want to kind of say just like the general, you know, like when my husband asked me like, well, what's it about? I gave him like the one line, which is probably going to irk you, but I'm just going to say it so that we're kind of on the same page. I just said, it's about a man who's a family man who has a successful career, who's going through a midlife crisis.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. No, I think that's fair. Yeah.
So this is kind of the one sentence, you know, back of the book. Mm-hmm. If you kind of want to know who Elijah Campbell is on the surface. I love that, because in interior here's so much more. But on the surface, he's a successful, you know, writer, he's a family man and he's going through a midlife crisis. So that's just kind of where we are, so that people who haven't yet picked up a copy of the book right. will kind of know where we're starting from. And there's lots of themes that we'll get into later, but since you already opened the door and said, this is the first time you've come on, in this season is the first time you've talked about a novel that you've written. Cause you're a psychologist. You write nonfiction books. Right. You're a Christian psychologist. So, yes. I mean, where
did this come from?
Where did this come from? I'm glad it came out, but where did this come from and all of that?
So, you know, it's interesting that you talk, I mean, I think you put your finger on it really well. It's about a family man, successful writing career, who's having a midlife crisis. And then the question at the heart of the book is, how do you turn a midlife crisis into a midlife awakening? And it doesn't come easy. It doesn't happen by staying on the surface of things, on the surface of your life or yourself. And so the hope that emerged in this was to portray what it really looks like really what it takes, what it costs, and the rewards of having a true midlife awakening, which I think we all are longing for. And by midlife, I don't necessarily mean 42 years old or whatever, even though he happens to be 39, but that moment in your life. And I describe it as the midlife moment where you realize everything that's gotten you here isn't working anymore, right? All the stuff that worked to get you here isn't working anymore. And so I was actually in a situation where I had a 2-book contract with InterVarsity Press. True Companions was the first one. But the contract said you have to pitch a second book before True Companions comes out. So this would have been summer of 2020, middle of COVID. I had a broken collarbone going over the handlebars of my bike. I'm on the phone with my agent and she says, so what do you got, Kelly? What's your idea for your next nonfiction book? And I said, well, I've got this image of a bridge, and it's this sort of broken down bridge in the middle of our life. And to get to more graceful ground, we have to cross that bridge, but it's sort of scary and uncertain. So what most of us do is we keep sort of treading the same ground we've been on, right? And that's how we create a midlife crisis is, well, I thought money was going to get me where I wanted to go and it hasn't. So just make more money and maybe that'll do the trick. Or I thought my relationships were going to perfectly fulfill me and they haven't. So, you know, divorce this one and marry a different one. That's how we create crises, is by just more of the same. And I want to sort of write a book about crossing that bridge. And here's my idea, is that the Beatitudes could sort of serve as the guides across that bridge. They're the sort of the teaching that helps us find more graceful ground. And she said, and this is a critical moment. It's why I dedicated the book to Kathy. She said, well, what if the Beatitudes were actually people? Like, what if you personified the Beatitudes as guides who walk you across that bridge? And I said, Kathy, that's crazy. It's a nonfiction book. And she said, as she always says, we'll just sit with it for a month, because we have a monthly call on the book. Sit with it for a month and we'll see what you think. And so I sat with it for a month and I thought, well, one way I could really kind of retain the nonfiction element of this is if each of those Beatitudes were represented by a lost loved one from my life. Who I'm in conversation with in the context of the pages. And those lost loved ones help walk me through to more graceful ground in my life. And so we pitched that idea to InterVarsity Press and they came back and said, we think it would work better as fiction. Great concept, but we like it as fiction. In my whole life, I've dreamt of writing a book since I read my first one, you know? And so naturally I was like scared to death. And I was like, I dreamt of writing a novel since I read my first one. And so my first reaction to InterVarsity Press was like, nope, I'm not interested. I'm going to repitch this to you as a nonfiction so you'll understand. And then they came back again and said they thought it would work better as fiction. And once again, Kathy said, take a month with it and see what you think. And that month turned into The Unhiding of Elijah Campbell. I mean, it took me about 6 months to write, but that first month is where the novel really sort of arrived. Yeah.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that. I feel like a naive reader. I'm like, oh no, did it pan out that way? Am I supposed to know which characters were,
well,
were which in the book?
That's a great question, because what's interesting about it is I learned that with writing nonfiction, you really have to see the whole book for the most part at the start. But with fiction, you can't do that, because you create characters and put them in situations and they start to do things that they're not supposed to, if it's going to be any good, right? Which is a total thrill. It was a spiritual practice of letting go of control for me, wow, the author. But so what you will notice, and I think we can say this without, we're going to try to avoid any spoilers today.
We're both going to try.
But his first conversation with his grandmother, if you'll notice, is the conversation with Blessed Are the Poor in Spirit. That poorness of spirit is the bridge that takes us from superficial happiness to deep joy and abiding joy. And then the second conversation with his grandfather is Blessed Are Those Who Mourn. And I think in that one, it's grief is what takes us from clinging to safety to being able to abide in a sense of resilience. And so all was going as planned up till that point. He's having his conversations with the Beatitudes. And right around that time, I showed the manuscript to Kathy. And once again, this is why I dedicated it to her, her hands all over it. She said, this is becoming more than you originally planned. These characters are real now. I want to know what they're going to do.
Yes.
And you need to write as if you want to know what they're going to do. Not that you know, right? And sure enough,
wise woman.
You have wise woman. Oh my goodness. I'm so blessed by her. And sure enough, in the very next scene, without spoiling anything, I'd just written a scene where Elijah comes out of recalling one of his core childhood wounds. And I had it planned that he was going to go talk to the next grandparent, and he wouldn't go. Like, he literally was like, no, I'm not going to come out of what I just experienced and go have a chat with another grandparent. Like, that's not, I need to take time. I need to process. I need to lick my wounds. And in the next scene, he ends up in a local park having a memory of being there before. And that's when the book sort of, you know, some of the themes of the book started to really emerge. Like, you can't, if you can't speak it, you can't transform it. You know, if you can't unhide it, you can't heal it, these sorts of things. So, so that was, you can hear me getting excited, because that was the moment where I feel like I became a novelist and I can't go back. It was such a thrill.
Well, I'm telling you that I'm recalling reading, and yes, I recall both of those first two conversations, and then probably in that space where you just said, this is where it picked up and Elijah wouldn't go. You know, I thought, well, that's right, because Elijah has a mind of his own. Why are you trying to,
that's right,
why are you trying to push him to do something
that's right,
that he doesn't want to do, you know, like because his character became so real to me. And I think I will tell you this, there are a lot of scary moments in the book.
Yes.
Elijah as a character, you know, he walks through a lot of these, like you've alluded to some wounding from his past and these memories. But even in his present and in his uncertain future, that created a lot of feelings of fear for me, for Elijah, right? Like, I'm feeling kind of afraid for him. Yeah. If I can pull myself out of the novel for a second, I will tell you one of the things as a reader that this did for me going through this story, as you're describing it, was I often, because you and I had spoken before and I had read True Companions, I often went back in my mind just for a second, just for a touch base, to remind myself that you wrote this because it felt very uncertain. And even some of the advice he was given, or some of the conclusions he came to, sometimes felt very uncertain. But as I was reading it, it's hard for me to describe. I felt safe knowing the mind that it came from, if that makes sense at all. So, you know, I was kind of like, I'm not going through this as someone who like is unaware or someone who's just kind of guessing and throwing something out there. Right. I'm like, this is an educated, believing practitioner who, you know, has a track record. And it's not that I'm not saying you're perfect in your career, but I'm just saying like sure. I felt like this wisdom that I was receiving along with Elijah, right? At this similar time, I'm only a couple of years older than him. You know, that I was receiving some of this wisdom, and I had to kind of look back because in those uncertain spaces, when I reminded myself who the author was, it felt safe.
Thank you for that. I mean, I receive that as a wonderful compliment. And it reminds me of, I was watching the movie Soul by yes. Disney Pixar.
Yep.
And the first time through it, I could not enjoy it at all. Cause I was like, if they don't land this right, this is a disastrous message for an entire generation of young people. And they landed it so well. And I was like, okay, now I can go back and read it right. Relaxed. And, you know, so what a compliment that you trusted me throughout that I was going to land okay.
I did, but I had to go back to that. I mean, honestly, because like I said, I don't read a ton of fiction. And so a lot of it for me was that's me as a personality. Like I have sometimes kind of some issues letting go and just letting my imagination, you know, and all of this stuff. And Elijah is dealing with some very difficult situations. I mean, he's dealing with tragedy. He's dealing with, wounding like kind of covers it, right? Like he's dealing with a lot of trauma in his life, and it felt difficult to kind of walk with his character through the book. One place you've already mentioned a couple of themes that were articulated really well, and I want to come back to those, but one thing that I jotted down that felt really prominent in the first part of the book, and I think a lot of people listening to this would resonate with this as well. When Elijah is struggling to hear God.
Yes.
And there's a place where I don't remember who says it, but the idea comes across that trauma has a way of silencing the voice of God.
Yeah.
And Elijah's, I don't think he's put it all together at that point, like what's happening and what's going on in his mind. So I'm gonna toss that ball to you as the psychologist and say that was something that stood out to me. And that is a theme throughout the book. So what does that have to do? You can answer it however you want, but like, what does that have to do with our midlife crisis/awakening? What is, you know, how many people are affected by this right now? It's a really, you know, a lot of seems like that's this right. trauma study is coming, you know, we're learning more and more about these things. I don't know. Take that somewhere, would you?
Yeah. I'll see what I can do. See what I can do with that.
You're, come on, Kelly. Know. I've thrown something at you. Take it. I don't know like what to do with it.
Like I said, I'm new at this kind of thing. And that's the first time someone's asked me about that part of the book, but I really appreciate it. The idea in the book around the silence of God is that we can basically trust that God is never silent, that a dark night of the soul is not God being coy and sort of testing us to see if we can handle his silence. But a dark night of the soul is a season in which we are, for whatever reason, not tuned into the same wavelength as God, so to speak. And so Father Lou in the book, sort of the spiritual anchor of the book, says, when you can't hear God, it's not because God isn't kind of speaking. It's because he's waiting to have a new conversation, a different kind of conversation, right? And this sort of sends Elijah on his journey of finding places in his hometown that he can really feel a sense of almost like a sense of time folding in on itself and a reconnection with his people in that space. And so that begins to stimulate in him a reconnection with the voice of God in him in this sort of creative, very rooted, tangible sort of way in the town. Yet in the story, he discovers that there's places in the town that are connected to experiences he once had that are so traumatic that he just loses all of his flexibility to have a new conversation, right? Which is really what trauma is. It's a loss of flexibility, of mental and emotional flexibility. It's, I'm rooted in a past event and have an inability to experience the present apart from that event. Normally I can sort of work with my fear and find other ways to perceive or experience or evaluate a situation. But in trauma, for instance, I can't. I can only feel the fear. Reality seems permanently sort of stuck in this space. So I think that's part of what the story is illustrating in that part of the story is trauma has a way of sort of costing us our emotional, spiritual, and psychological flexibility. And it takes a lot of work to get it back, but we can, it just takes an awful lot of work to do it. And much of the rest of the story is the work that it takes to get that flexibility back.
All right. I might have to have you slow down because I didn't know I was going to take as many notes today as I am.
Sure.
As I am. It happens on occasion. I've learned that it happens on occasion. I come in usually with like a half a page of notes, and then there are certain conversations that I end up taking another half a page. And so
All right. You
know, if I have to flip through it, sorry, but Absolutely. Man, that's really good in that. I had told you before we hit record that now I'm like, I want to read more fiction because I have all these images, you know, of Elijah's town and places in my head. And I'm imagining some of those places as you're explaining that, right? But that's an amazing word picture, that loss of flexibility. Mm-hmm. You can't have a new conversation.
Mm-hmm. Not by himself.
No. Yeah. And Father Lou, the spiritual anchor of the book, I'm like, I want a Father Lou, in my life. Right. It makes me think like training to be a pastor makes me think, well, maybe if I don't have a Father Lou, maybe I could be a little miniature Father Lou, to somebody, moving forward because Elijah needs the stability. Right. But also the challenge, I think, that Dr. Lou, provides for him. And I'm going to stop there so I don't go into my crying this morning at the coffee shop with the end of Dr. Luke, right? All of that. But there's the trauma. You also talked about the hiding before, and of course the book is called The Unhiding. But I have that on my notes right before I have the self-preservation. And that theme, if you can elaborate kind of on that theme, that was a real prominent one for me, especially near middle and end of the book, that idea of self-preservation and how it's, there are characters who say, but this is actually helpful, Elijah. And then he realizes that it's the way he's been living Absolutely. It, it's actually not helpful.
Yes.
So what is that in us, and how can we, steward that?
Yeah. So, there's this point, and it doesn't happen. It happens somewhere relatively early, I think, in our childhoods. This is something I wrote about in Lovable quite extensively. There's this point where, a kid sort of takes it for granted that they're worthy of love and belonging the way that they are. Like they don't come into the world questioning that. And at some point, each one of us experiences this thing called shame, which is the message that you're not good enough for love and belonging the way that you are. You're going to, if you keep showing up in the world the way that you are, you're going to keep getting rejected. You're going to keep getting hurt. You're going to keep collecting pain. And so one of the ways I often describe shame is the instinct to hide. That's what shame is. It's, what I am, if it keeps showing up, is just going to collect pain. So I need to hide who I am. So most of, and I think hiding is the first method of self-preservation that most young people go through, right? So it's usually starting sometime in, mid-elementary school at the latest. And so most of life, most of the progression out of childhood and into adulthood is a progression into hiding of some sort or another. And so much of healing is about simply unhiding. Learning to show up as yourself, trusting that you are worthy enough to show up in the world, that the pain you collect as an authentic, vulnerable human being isn't telling the truth about you. It's telling the truth about those who are hurting you more than you. This is the, but very few of us even know we're hiding. Like Elijah doesn't know, really.
Right.
He's not calling it hiding. He's calling it love. Mm. He's saying, oh, I put these things away and I don't show them to you because I want to love you and I want the best life for you. And I don't, you know? And so I think one of the things that I hear from readers coming out of this book is we hide because we're ashamed. And then we feel ashamed of the ways that we hide, which is just going to promote more hiding. And the way that this book is breaking that cycle is people going, oh, I hide and I'm not ashamed of it anymore. I read Elijah's story. I understood why he hides. I can understand why I hide, and I can stop doing that. I can break that cycle now because the shame about the hiding is broken in the reading of the story, which to me is like, oh, like it's all I could hope for.
It's huge. It's huge. And like I said, I was talking about shame. I felt freed and slightly embarrassed as I was reading this book because, and there's been a lot of talk, especially in the last several years, I think at least that I've been keened into about, you know, how powerful story is, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, this isn't a real life story. It is. But it's about a fictional character. Mm-hmm. And I just kept thinking about, how I am praying that the power of Elijah's story would follow me and would lead me. And that this was different than reading like another kind of, you know, Christian, you know, self-help or psychology or, you know, whatever. And all of those things are helpful. And you've written some great books like that. Right. But that we kind of feel, the reader kind of feels what Elijah's feeling. It's what you said, like, oh, that's what that's called. He's been hiding. And if, you know, and there's a little courage in that too, to recognize that and to come out and say, oh, I don't have to hide in that way. Or maybe, you know, maybe I call it love like Elijah, or maybe I call it something different, but it really is the hiding that you're talking about. It really is the shame that you're talking about. And I think it releases, I don't know, part of what I felt in Elijah was that it releases other people from that.
Absolutely.
And so part of what you're talking about in some of his major relationships, he kind of has this expectation that that's what they expect of him is to do this. When if he had been unhidden, if he had been honest with himself, it would have opened up that dialogue for the people in his life to be honest with him and could have actually served as a catalyst for his unhiding instead of him keeping it.
Yes,
and,
absolutely.
And it served as a catalyst to him continuing to hide.
Well, and I think that's where you go, you know, as you point out, the self-preservation and the hiding sort of together in your notes is the question for all of us is, are we going to be able to arrive at the point where we recognize that thing we do is really a self-protective mechanism that is now backfiring, right? Like if I'm hiding because I don't want to be hurt, but the excess loneliness I'm creating through that hiding for myself is excess hurt. And then the disconnection that's creating in all of my relationships is hurt for them. So I'm actually like, it's backfiring, the thing that I tried to do to minimize the hurt for everybody. And can we realize that and recognize that and start to do something new? And that's the question mark. And what's it going to take for us? You know, like, I think that was one of the more compelling, like, what is it going to take for me as the author to really finally start to change some of those methods of self-protection? I hope it doesn't take what it took for Elijah,
right?
You know, and that to me is one of the great hopes for the book too, is that in watching Elijah go through it, the reader can go, I think I'd like to change some of the things I'm doing before I get to that point.
Yes.
You know, like we get to benefit from his story that way.
But before he gets to lots of different points, right? In the story, but yes, absolutely. But I think in that, So kind of to your point, in that we can see that, yes, amen, there is hope for us to change it before we get to the point of Elijah. And it also helps it. I don't know. I think it helped me a little bit with, I don't know, to say the gravity might be the wrong picture I want to paint, but it kind of helped me to say, well, A, this is human and, you know, kind of normal, but also B, like, it really is damaging. Mm-hmm. You know, even if I'm not to the point of Elijah, this really isn't, it's not promoting health for me.
Right.
It's not promoting health in my relationships. Just because I don't look like Elijah did, that doesn't mean that it's the most healthy thing I can be doing.
Well, and to take that word damaging, because, you know, our shame can do all sorts of things with that. And to say simply like some of the most common damage is to prevent the thriving of our belonging with each other, which is what we're here for, right? We are here wired to long for belonging, to cultivate it, create it through our authenticity and connection. And so the great harm is the lack of flourishing of our belonging. And hopefully what starts to emerge, you know, in this book is an image of what belonging is possible if we can start to undo some of those patterns.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's really good. Something that I'm kind of hoping you can touch on without kind of a spoiler alert, is that Elijah has an interesting, he discovers, I think, that he has had an interesting relationship with loyalty.
Mm. Yes.
And that felt profound to me. Mm-hmm. As I read through that, it also felt a little bit, I don't want to say confusing, but I think it felt a little bit kind of big for me, in part because, you know, there's a toss up on the Enneagram of what I most identify with, but if I kind of lean into this sixth part, you know, uh-huh. I mean the loyalty, right? I mean, I was just having a conversation with a friend of mine who's a six, and we joked like we will not only go down with the ship, right? Like, I mean, right. It's like, that's even too soon for us to jump, right? It's not, yes, that, I mean, it's this like, and I think it can be almost a sense of pride for people like me who are loyal to the very, yes, end, right? Of like, yes, this, but this is where we stand. And this says something about our character, you know, yes, that we have this loyalty. And then I see Elijah having this complicated relationship with loyalty.
Yes. Yes.
And it got me to think about this in ways that I hadn't thought about it before. So I'm trying really hard not to just say
it's
what
so
I want to say,
isn't it? I know.
About this. But maybe you can talk, maybe you can speak to that idea a little bit.
Well, and my response to that is hard to withhold as well, because that scene you're describing, was probably my favorite scene in the whole, wow, book to write, because it was the biggest surprise to me. I knew that Elijah had enlisted some help to have a conversation with a loved one from his past, and he needed that help because there was trauma connected to it. And that, so they were going to sort of role play this conversation instead of having it be in his imagination. And I didn't know anything else about that conversation. I didn't know how it was going to go when I sat down to write, wow, it. And by the end of it, I felt, raw,
yeah,
about what had happened, and that something true had been said there that I was still trying to understand. And I think it's this idea that, because you're right, like loyalty is like the best of things. I mean, we just said belonging, right? Like, yeah, is there any, I mean, yeah, loyalty is belonging at its best in a sense, you know? The thing that I think is being wrestled with in that scene is, I mean, we could say, what are the costs of loyalty? And not in a selfish way, but in a way that's related to our own authenticity and showing up and growth and transformation. So for instance, like if one of your kids' friends asked them to use drugs and said, hey, you're a loyal friend, right? We don't tell anybody about this. All of a sudden loyalty doesn't feel as like the highest value in that situation.
Right.
And so that's, I think, what Elijah starts to wrestle with, is he was equating loyalty at any cost, at the cost of every other value, right? At the cost of every other moral and ethic, above and beyond all of those, he was equating that to love. And that was the reason he wasn't ever allowed to question that, is that if you question loyalty at the cost of everything else, then you're not loving me, right? And so it just sort of opens up some complicated questions about the dividing line between loyalty and blind allegiance, I guess maybe would be a way of saying it, and the complicated emotional work it takes to sort of discern that and free oneself from blind allegiance.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. Thanks for touching on that. It felt really big for me too. And even as I continued throughout the rest of the book, just kind of thinking about that and that particular relationship that he was, trying to resolve some things was helpful.
Well, and maybe it's like to boil it down to a really practical level. If you're feeling if you're feeling a call, the loyalty to someone, and you share a secret, the two of you, you could say to that person, if I share that secret with somebody, if I own my truth and share that with somebody, will you still be loyal to me? And all of a sudden you might discover, oh, the loyalty is only going one way here.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so loyalty is a complicated relational dynamic for sure that Elijah gets faced with.
It is. Yeah. And that was one that I hadn't, anticipated kind of coming across that as I read that, because that scene was particularly like kind of graphic in my mind for me. I'm like, whoa, sure. Be like, that actually just happened. I think I'm going to ask maybe one last thematic question, and then I really want to let you take it for sure wherever you want to take it. It can feel like the other side of the coin of loyalty in some ways. I wish I had written down the quote, but I knew I was going to try to not do this like a book club. But there was a line about surrender. About surrender being kind of, I'm being binary here on purpose, but like kind of being good or bad, depending upon who or what you're surrendering to.
Right. Yes.
And how that plays out in Elijah's life, but also how it plays out in all of our, I feel like it's almost it's a huge difference between, a crisis and an awakening.
Absolutely. That's a really nice connection you made, I think. That it is the difference between a crisis. Yeah, in a crisis, you're refusing to surrender the habits, the things that you've been doing, the whole worldview that says these things should be working to get me where I want to go. Right. And if those things aren't totally true, then actually surrendering them is a good thing. And surrender is a beautiful thing. Mm. Yeah, I'm right there with you. I'm not sure if we talked about it last time, but I can't help but see every human being as this complicated mixture of their true self, their soul, as they were created in God's image, and then the false self or ego that they built around that soul to protect it, which we've sort of been talking about in different ways today already. The ego, this protective, self-preserving sort of persona that we've created, it doesn't speak the language of surrender. Like it just doesn't do it. It doesn't know how. It doesn't understand why anyone would ever surrender.
Don't burst my bubble, Kelly.
Well, you're talking to Mr. Competitive himself. So I mean, much of my life is trying to figure out how to do that. So a lot of times surrender doesn't even feel good because it's the ego dying in the midst of the surrender. Right. So surrendering to something good can even feel bad if the ego is what's having to sort of die away in order for that to happen. Lose your life for my sake in order to find it. You could substitute ego for life, lose your ego for me in order to find your true self. Like, that doesn't feel good to the ego. And so surrender too ends up a complicated experience in a lot of ways.
Yeah. I mean, for sure. I feel like
you're jotting things down again.
I am. Someone grab my pen. I'm kind of done like picking your brain, but only because I really want you to be able to share more of the things that were really meaningful for you. The truth is, I could sit here and have a conversation with you all day about this book, and it might I would do it with the microphone off, so I didn't have to worry about the spoilers. But you named a couple of themes at the beginning of our conversation that I would love it if you went back to. One was about unhiding, and what was the other one?
Yeah. There's that first sentence of the book. The past is, you know, always behind us, but it is also always within us.
Yes.
And this question of, can you really let go of your past, or do you need to learn how to do something different with it? So I think that's, and actually if there's a refrain in the book, it's that sentence that is probably used half a dozen times in the book. So that's a significant theme of the book. So I have a thought, I guess, would be, what if I read the prologue? Just read it.
Absolutely.
And that wouldn't spoil anything for anybody.
Right. That's right. That's right. Yep.
And it could give folks more of a sense of what we're talking about when we talk about the past being behind us and all these themes that we've been discussing in the book. And then maybe we could unpack that concept of the
Go
past.
For it. I'd be honored. That'd be great.
Okay. Yeah. I'm going to have to scoot away to grab my copy of my book here. All right. So I think this should take about 2 minutes, listeners. Give me a minute and I think you'll be hooked. All right. The past is behind us, but it is also always within us, which means the past can feel dead and gone one moment, and then in the next, it can be very much living and breathing and here. My past came back to life in the form of a nightmare I hadn't dreamed in over 30 years. When I was a child, the nightmare always began the same way, with me standing at a river's edge, watching it rush by, brownly opaque with mud, swollen with storm debris, and foamy with turmoil. It was the kind of cataclysmic river in which a kid could disappear without warning, carried downstream to rot in some unpredictable destination. An old wooden bridge spanned the river. Though it had probably been a feat of humankind at its creation, its glory days were clearly behind it. The railings were gone. Most of the walkway had been torn away by storms long forgotten. The remaining planks were rotted and loose and spaced out, some resting where they were originally placed, some resting at angles. Large gaps in the walkway revealed the roiling waters just a few yards below it. Beyond the bridge, the other side of the river was always cloaked in fog. I had no idea what the fog hid, and yet, with the kind of certainty that can only be called faith, the kind of anticipation that can only be called hope, and the kind of longing that can only be called love, I wanted to find out. So I'd look down, preparing to take my first step, and I'd see on my feet a pair of worn-out blue sneakers with yellow trim. They were so dirty, the yellow looked almost brown, and the blue looked almost black. The shoe on my right foot had a hole at the front of it, and my big toe protruded, covered by a dusty sock. Every night, the dream seemed to contain all its previous renditions, so I knew exactly how it was going to end. I knew I would step out onto the bridge, and the water would rise, and it would be impossible to escape it. And as it reached me, I would silently scream myself awake. However, I also knew I'd step out onto the bridge anyway, yearning so much for the opposite shore that I was willing to endure the familiar terror at least one more time. Sometime around middle school, the dream seemed to die. I went to sleep one night and it didn't go with me. Weeks passed, no nightmare. Then months passed, then years. And somewhere along the way, I forgot about that old nightmare altogether. It turns out, though, it hadn't died. It had simply gone dormant. Or maybe it had died, and almost 3 decades later, on the cusp of my 40th birthday, it was resurrected. I don't think the future is ever predetermined, but I do think our futures are eventually determined by what we do with these moments of resurrection, especially when such moments cluster together, forming a sort of bridge in the middle of our life, one we may cross to new ground or one we may turn back from, retreading the ground from which we came. My bridge was made of that old nightmare. It was also made of a secret I kept from everyone so long I eventually began to keep it from myself, and a secret that was kept from me for so long I never knew it existed. My bridge is made of a bunch of lost loved ones who came to life again within the magic of memory and the mystery of imagination. It was made of a god I once loved who went silent and then one day started speaking to me again through those beloved ghosts of mine. In the Bible, Jesus dies on a Friday, and there's a lot of talk about that. Then he's resurrected on a Sunday, and there's even more talk about that. No one talks much about Saturday, though. Death and resurrection. No one talks much about the and that bridges the two. Sometimes, though, all of life can begin to feel like an and. Every day can start to feel like the Saturday between what happened to you and what you will or will not do with it. And once you recognize your bridge for what it is, you have to decide whether you'll cross it with no guarantees of surviving the passage, just the merest of hopes that it will deliver you to more graceful ground. It took me a long time to recognize my and, my Saturday, my bridge, for what it was. Too long. It began with a leg in my lap more than a decade before the nightmare resumed. My name is Elijah Campbell, and this is the story of my unhiding. So
I want to read it again.
So sort of core to the book there, right at the beginning, right, is this idea that, you know, and I guess it's the line of work I've been in forever, is we all want to be able to put our past behind us and go, and even some of us just think it's so silly. I remember going to my first counseling appointment and going, how silly, what a luxury to go to an appointment and talk about my past and complain, you know. And so we're all trying to put it behind us, but we can't. Like that's the, you know, that's the fly in the ointment. We can't. It's also within us. Everywhere we go, we carry our past forward with us. And one of the members of our online book club this summer, she just summarized it so beautifully. She said, I read this book and I realized my whole life I've been trying to let go of my past, but you can't let go of your past. However, you can learn to dialogue with it in a way that is healing and redemptive and changes what's happening now and changes your future because of the transformation that takes place in that. So, you know, that's, I think, one of my big hopes for the book is that we will, as people quit sort of, I don't want to use the word waste, that's judgmental, because I think we all have to try it. You know, you have to try to let go of your past to eventually discover you can't. But I hope we can get to that point more quickly where we realize our past is with us. And these days when I work with folks, I tell them, you know, that moment in any interaction, in any situation where you feel like this tightening in your chest or like a pit in your stomach or, you know, tension in your shoulders, and you just all that is actually, that tightening is your teacher. It's telling you that your past is actually kind of surfacing into this moment and saying, hey, I don't want to go through that again. I know how this feels. I'm not going to like this. I don't want to experience it again. And so your past is literally rising up into that moment. And it can become a moment of additional self-protection, or it can become a moment in which you get more acquainted with your past and decide what you're going to do with it differently. So that tightening moment is really a powerful sort of like red flag to say, hey, all the growth, all the transformation, all the healing is going to happen right here. And it can happen, I mean, as you know, talking to your husband or trying to parent your kids or, you know, running into a stranger at the supermarket. It can happen anywhere. I get excited about people repurposing that moment for healing rather than more protection.
Yeah, no, that's really good. To be like kind of more vulnerable than I'd been prepared to be this morning when I was leaving the coffee shop. I got back into my car and I noticed, you know, some people have like little, you know, beanie babies or little stuffed animals on their dashes or whatever. And so I was getting into my vehicle with all of my stuff with me, you know, and, sure, and, trying to crawl in, and the car next to me had a little, one of these little animals, and it immediately brought up something, you know, a memory from my past, yeah, which was, you know, wild. I just finished this book, yeah, but what was interesting is that, and I think this kind of, this goes to where I'd love for you to take us, if you will, but, you know, we started off by saying a lot of, Elijah's interactions are with loved ones who have gone on, right? They're where, right, they're with loved ones who have passed away. But part of the suspense for me was that Elijah has relationships with people who are still living, but they, those relationships don't look like what he would want them to look like.
Yes,
and, right, and that he can still though, experience healing, yes, and different dialogue with his past through, yes, that. And so when I saw this little animal, now, mm-hmm, I'll say at this point I've been in, you know, I've been seeing my therapist. She moved, I moved with her, you know, all of this for, I don't know, 6 or 7 years or something like this at this point, you know?
Yes.
And I was actually relieved because when I saw this, I didn't feel the thing that you're talking about. Like I didn't feel it. Like I recognized it and knew it was a thing.
Yes.
And I kind of questioned for a moment. I thought, oh, that's odd. I don't really feel that. But partially it is, well, yeah, but as you've said, like we've done a lot of work around this,
right?
Though, right? The conversations have changed. I was able to have, you know, some of those new conversations that Elijah talked about. And it actually felt like kind of odd, but also really, I think what it's intended to, really freeing at the same time, right?
Freeing is the word. That's the word. Yes, exactly. Freeing. I'm not completely inside of that experience anymore. Right. I'm outside of it now. Yeah, I think, I think another consistent piece of feedback I've gotten about the book is, you know, a lot of us, we are aware, we are very aware of our past. We are very aware of the relationships that were painful for us, but we're stuck in a situation where we think we either need to go to that person and get the apology or get the mea culpa or get something that's going to ease that pain, or we've said, hey, I've tried that, didn't work. They're 75 years old now. They're, you know, you're not going to teach an old dog new tricks. They've passed away, so there's no chance that I can heal this pain. So the other thing that we tend to do is just give up on any more healing in that regard. And so the idea that healing and forgiveness can happen, like genuinely, not just at a like, oh, I forgive them and I'll try not to think about them level, but at a soul level, that healing and forgiveness can happen without the participation of the other. And to illustrate a creative way even for that to happen and a process for that to happen. That's what I've received that feedback that, oh, wow, I've got a lot of healing I've left on the table that I can still do. I've got a lot of forgiveness I can still arrive at that I had not realized. And so the idea that we can be freed from some of that pain, freed from some of those old relationships, and that we can be in charge of that, you know, that process, rather than feeling like we're dependent upon somebody who won't participate, is just really exciting to me.
Yeah, no, that was one of the places in the book where I felt like I kind of felt scared for Elijah. And I was also like nervous for myself at the same time. And I will just say without spoiling it, because you've already said Father Lou plays a big, you know, spiritual role in the book. And I just want to bring that out too, as well. You know, like you can do that work. We can do that work. And with the support of each other, right? With the support of, you know, spiritual friends, but also with the support of, you know, therapists, like we can do that work. And we can call on other people to help us do that work. And I think what was super powerful for me in that is that when Elijah is experiencing these moments where he is called on his community, his close community to help him, there's frustration and safety as a result of that courage, right? Because those moments don't usually look like what Elijah wanted them to look
they
like.
Don't go the way he wants. That's it. Well, you know, he talked about like, why do stories speak to us so much? You know, in most stories, the protagonist sets out trying to solve their problem in one way, and they have to learn that they've got all the wrong ideas about how they're going to solve their problem. And that's what happens to Elijah in conversation after conversation. He goes to this person, his ally, you know, who definitely is, and they don't solve the problem the way that he wants them to. And he gets upset at them, you know? And so he just learns by repetition, like, oh, I'm going to have to solve this problem in an entirely new way. It's that old Einstein quote, you know, you can't solve a problem with the same questions that created it or something like that. So I think that's what Elijah learns to do. So I've got to find a new way to solve these problems. And he is surrounded by allies. He's got a therapist, he's got a clergy, he's got an old mentor, and he's got a current friend. They're all a significant part of his journey here. So it's super important we call people into our journey with us.
Yeah. Kelly, I've already said I could talk about this book all day. But we don't have all day. So what would you, you know, what would you like to, leave us with? And this is completely open-ended. What, you know, if there's, you know, a question that I didn't ask or a part that you wanted to talk about or, you know, or a prayer or another reading or in anything, I'm completely open to that. But what would you love for readers to hear at this moment that maybe we haven't covered to the extent that maybe you wish we would have?
Yeah. So I was just talking with someone recently and we were having a great conversation. It was just a regular conversation. And they're like, I feel like I'm getting free counseling from you.
Yes.
And I said, listen, any good conversation is free counseling between two people. Mm. Right. And so my encouragement to people listening in is, if you're thinking about taking a crack at the story is, go get actually two copies of it and give it to somebody you'd love to have a great conversation with. And in the same way that for both you and I here, like the impact of this story has been multiplied by our conversation about it together. You know, I think, even for me still having written it, go read the story and talk about it with somebody and experience the belonging of that. And also just get some free counseling from a great conversation.
That's good advice, Kelly. That's good advice. I'm so grateful for you, for your work, that you wrote this, that you took the you know, hey, maybe this could be a fiction and ran with it, because for a fictional book, there is so much truth here.
Thank you. That, and honestly, like if you ask what's one more piece of encouragement for folks, it's, I wanted to do this my whole life. And when I actually had the chance, it scared me to the point where I finished the book, went for a walk with a friend the next day and told him I finished it. And he said, well, so have you sent it to the publisher? And I said, no, I don't think I'm going to. I really think I should write a book about following your passions. And my good friend looked at me and said, how are you going to write a book about following your passions if you're not following your passion for writing a novel? And so my encouragement to folks out there is, beyond all of this that we've been talking about, I hope me sort of stepping off my beaten path and writing a novel is an encouragement to you to pay attention to the things you're wanting to do. It doesn't have to be a novel, it could be anything. And just the more scared you are of it, probably the more important it is to your evolution. So think about doing it.
Oh my goodness. That's a word too. The more scared you are.
That is paraphrased from a great encourager of creative Stephen Pressfield. So yeah.
That's amazing. All right. Well, the link is going to be here. I feel like we should put a link with the thing that already has the two in the dropdown, but The Hiding of Elijah Campbell, a novel by Kelly Flanagan. Kelly, thank you once again.
Alexis, that was an awesome conversation without spoiling anything. Thank you.
We made it.
We did it.
The links for all the resources mentioned in today's episode can be found in the show notes. Music and podcast production by Seth Busetti. Be sure to give us a review on iTunes and subscribe at your favorite podcast listening app. You can also visit us at thatmakestotalsense.com.